Welcome to iHeartRadio Communities, a public affairs special focusing on the biggest issues impacting you this week. Here's Ryan Gorman.
Thanks for joining us here on iHeartRadio Communities. I'm Ryan Gorman, and we have some important conversations lined up for you. In a moment, I'll check in with the CEO of the World Health Organization Foundation to talk about their Go Give One campaign, an effort to accelerate global COVID-19 vaccinations. Then I'll talk to a threat management expert about different ways you can keep yourself and your family safe in an increasingly dangerous world. First up, to get things started, I'm joined by Anil Soni, the Chief Executive Officer of the World Health Organization Foundation, which focuses on tackling today's biggest health challenges, including the current COVID-19 pandemic. You can find out more about their Go Give One campaign at gogiveone.org. Anil, thanks for taking a few minutes to talk to us. And let's begin with a broad overview of the work the World Health Organization Foundation does.
Of course. Well, it's great to talk to you, Ryan. So great to speak to all of the people who listen to iHeartRadio on your program. And WHO Foundation, the World Health Organization Foundation, exists to better connect individuals all around the world to the work of the WHO. The WHO has become a household acronym. I believe this last year with COVID-19, it's leading the world's response to this pandemic and leads the world's response to other diseases and outbreaks. The WHO Foundation's purpose is to mobilize more support for the work of the WHO, including all of the individuals listening to this program, through campaigns like Go Give One.
And like you said, I'm sure most everyone listening has heard of the WHO at some point during this pandemic, but they may not have a full understanding of the role the organization plays in global health. Can you break that down for us?
Absolutely. The WHO has existed for 70 years as part of the United Nations to help every country in the world, rich and poor, plan for and respond to pandemics like COVID-19, to develop guidelines for how to prevent and treat disease, to provide some of the functions that you're used to the US FDA providing in terms of checking the safety and quality of medicines and tests, and being a leader to national governments, particularly in lower income countries, prepare for the type of pandemics and disease outbreaks, and also just building stronger health systems for the millions and really billions of people out there who don't have the type of healthcare that we as Americans are used to.
What's so unique about this particular global health crisis? Because like you mentioned, there have been many health issues the WHO has responded to in the past, but is this one the largest?
Yes. COVID-19 is the biggest pandemic the world has seen in 100 years. And it's unique. And I think everyone who's listening to this knows this because it's touched all of our lives. Everyone all over the world was affected and is affected by COVID-19. It's a disease and an infection that spreads rapidly. It affects everyone. And it's caused all of our countries to react, our economies to shut down, for us to stay at home, to wear masks, to really change our way of life in a very short amount of time. And that solidarity that we felt and fear and anxiety a year ago, we're trying to create that solidarity again in response, in hope, in action through this new campaign, Go Give One. COVID-19 affected all of us, and Go Give One is an opportunity for all of us to respond together.
I'm joined by Anil Soni, the Chief Executive Officer of the World Health Organization Foundation. You can find out more about their Go Give One campaign at gogiveone.org. So here in the U.S., we're still getting Americans vaccinated, but we've definitely turned the corner in terms of the outbreak and hospitalizations and deaths. What is the situation like in other parts of the world?
Well, Ryan, thank you for asking, and thanks to all of you for listening to understand, to empathize with what's happening around the world. I am so glad that people in the United States are feeling hope and getting access to vaccines. That is not what's happening in other parts of the world. Only 1 in 500 people who have gotten a vaccine on this planet are in low-income countries. People in lower-income countries don't have access, and as a consequence, the virus is still out of control on many parts of the earth, including in India, which is suffering massive numbers of new infections, deaths, and despair. And so really what we are trying to encourage everyone to understand is feel that hope, feel that joy as your life gets back to normal, but act in solidarity with those who don't feel that way by giving. By giving $7 to go give one, you're going to allow someone else to get vaccinated. And that's incredibly important. It feels good. It's morally, I think, the right thing to do. And also, it's what we need in terms of the disease and in terms of our economies, because until this pandemic is over everywhere, it's not going to be over anywhere. Not really.
So what was the impetus for the creation of this Go Give One campaign?
We want to give everyone everywhere a chance to act to end COVID-19. Of course, governments need to do their part. We need billions of dollars to fund the international response to COVID-19, to fund all the vaccines that are necessary. But individual action is what moves governments. Individual action is what moves the world. And we wanted to create an opportunity to shorten the distance between every one of you listening and the fund that is buying vaccines for everyone in the world, starting with those who need it most. That's what Go Give One is. It's an opportunity for you to do just that. Go give one. $7, go to a website, spend a couple of minutes, and be proud that you've contributed to vaccines going to people who need them all around the world.
We've spent a lot of time over the past few months talking about the challenges of getting people here in the U.S. vaccinated, but what are some of the challenges you're seeing in other countries?
Well, there are many challenges, including ensuring that we have enough vaccine supply. So there's many companies that are developing vaccines that are scaling up manufacturing. We need more vaccine supply. We need countries to share their supply, especially countries like the United States that has an excess amount of vaccines, way more than is needed to vaccinate every single American man, woman, and child. And we need money to buy those vaccines. These are not expensive. $7 for a vaccine, that's amazing. $7 to save a life, but we need billions of dollars because we need to vaccinate most of the planet. So the funding is absolutely a need, and we believe individuals can make a huge difference by pitching in.
And one quick follow-up. What about the physical challenge of getting these vaccines to people? I imagine in certain regions of the world, that can be pretty tough.
It's an incredible task. This is one of the most complex public health challenges that the world has ever seen. We need to supply these products, these vaccines, some of which require refrigeration, to very remote parts of the world. And that means we need healthcare workers, we need storage packs, we need vehicles to get to these places around the world. We need messaging for communities to make sure that they understand the vaccine is available and that it's safe. We need support on the regulatory front to check the safety and efficacy of these medicines. We need pharmacovigilance, which means we need to know how people are reacting so we can make sure that countries know how to administer the vaccine safely. All of that work is what the World Health Organization does. It's what other partners do to support national governments. And that work is critically important. And we are asking for national governments, for donor governments, wealthy governments, the G7, to fund that work. What we're looking to individuals to do is really easy. Like that complex work that has to get funded, we're working on that. But we want every individual to know they can do something really simple. $7 buys a vaccine, and we'll make sure that all of those other pieces that you mentioned are in place so that vaccine gets to the people who need it.
I'm joined by Anil Soni, the Chief Executive Officer of the World Health Organization Foundation. You can find out more about their Go Give One campaign at gogiveone.org. I know what we've been going through is something you and your team prepare for, but what have you learned throughout this pandemic that maybe you didn't realize going into it?
Well, certainly we need to be better prepared as a planet. National governments need to put pandemics high on the list of potential threats so that when we see evidence of a new pandemic, we can respond more quickly. We need to find the right balance between tackling the pandemic and also making sure we can keep our economies running smoothly. We need to make sure that we are marshaling the science as quickly as possible. And that's been pretty good for COVID-19 in terms of developing new vaccines and tools, therapies, diagnostics. But the faster we can do that, the more prepared we are to respond to pandemics. There's also something that I feel like I've learned, which is making sure that we're giving individuals agency. I felt proud when I wore a mask last year because I knew I was protecting not just myself, but the people around me. And when I was given guidance by officials who were fighting COVID-19 on what I could do to do my part, that was incredibly powerful for me. And that's what we're trying to do with Go Give One, give individuals agency. The more that all of us are recruited in the response to this pandemic or pandemics in the future, the faster we're going to defeat them.
Another aspect of all of this that I wanted to ask you about, at the same time we're dealing with COVID, there are other health issues impacting different parts of the world. Has the pandemic had an effect on those battles too?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great question. COVID-19, because people had to stay at home all around the world, because we shut down in many ways individual movement, we have a real challenge with other diseases because people weren't going to pharmacy or a health clinic to get a malaria bed net, to get treated or diagnosed if they had tuberculosis, to make sure that people were getting their HIV treatment, which they need to take every single day. Because of that break in the continuity of care, we absolutely have a lot of recovery to do to make sure that once COVID-19 is over, we are reaching everyone with the healthcare that they've essentially put on pause. So we have a lot of recovery to do, but we need to build back better. And what we're finding is a couple of things. One is vaccines are so important because if we can prevent a disease from happening before it happens in the first place, gosh, that's a lot easier than treating it or waiting until someone gets sick, which is just harder because it means someone has to come to a healthcare center and take up resources, which, as we've learned this last year, are just precious. The other thing we've learned is we want to bring healthcare to where someone is. The more people can take care of themselves, the more we can rely on community healthcare workers to deliver healthcare in the community, in someone's home, the more effective we're going to be when people can't make it to a clinic or a hospital.
I'm joined by Anil Soni, the Chief Executive Officer of the World Health Organization Foundation. Going back to the Go Give One campaign for a quick moment, and everyone can find out more at gogiveone.org. One more time, what exactly can those listening to this show do to help? And can you also explain where exactly their donation is going to be going?
Absolutely. Go Give One is a COVID-19 fundraising campaign giving everyone everywhere the chance to play their part in helping to truly end the pandemic. By giving $7, each of us can buy a vaccine for someone, a father, a daughter, a grandparent in the world, in low-income countries, in the places where people are most vulnerable. The money goes to a fund called COVAX AMC. This is the fund that was set up by the United Nations and international organizations, the one place to buy vaccines for people in the world, for about 100 countries, lower income countries, to ensure that vaccines are getting to those who need them most in countries that can't afford them. Governments are giving money to this fund, to the COVAX AMC, but not enough to end the pandemic. That's why the WHO Foundation created Go Give One. What you can do, what you listening can do, is go to www.gogiveone.org. And you can make a contribution, and you can be confident that that contribution is going to buy a vaccine for someone in need.
Anil Soni, the Chief Executive Officer of the World Health Organization Foundation. You can find out more about their Go Give One campaign at gogiveone.org. Anil, thank you so much for the time and insight. We really appreciate it.
Ryan, thank you so much, and thanks to all your listeners.
All right. And finally, I'm joined now by Spencer Corson, an expert in threat management, the founder of the Corson Security Group and author of the new book, The Safety Trap, A Security Expert's Secrets for Staying Safe in a Dangerous World. Spencer, thanks so much for coming on the show. I guess the place to start would be, what led you to a career in threat management in the first place?
Ryan, thanks so much for having me on. Being a protector is a craft I've honed my entire life. My parents got divorced when I was like 5 years old, and one of my early core memories was my grandfather coming over to the house and being like, "All right, you're the man of the house now. You gotta look after your sisters." And so then I grew up watching TV shows like The A-Team and Knight Rider and Lone Ranger, and Kung Fu, where this guy would come out of the wilderness and help a family or help an individual, solve a problem and then go away. And wow, man, this is fascinating. And then as I started getting older and reading more books like, Tom Clancy's Without Remorse or Dead of Honor, and realized that there was this whole global landscape of professional protectors, I just knew that that was what I wanted to do. Did an internship at the Justice Department in college, joined the Army after that, worked for the government, private sector. And then in 2012, I went into business for myself because I realized, after the tragedy at Sandy Hook, that while not everyone will know the luxury of having their own protective detail, every single one of us deserves to be protected. My business kind of pivoted away from skill sets which were employable for the top 1% and made them more readily available to the other 99%. And this book is a continuation of that effort so that you can read this book, come for the story, stay for the lesson. And in the meantime, you are mastering the strategies to help you keep you and your loved ones protected.
And before we get into some of the tips that you have in your book for how people can keep themselves and their families safe, I was wondering if you could take us behind the curtain for a moment, what it's like to handle security details for celebrities and public and political figures, some aspects of that that might be interesting that the public might not know or realize.
How much work truly goes into it? It's very easy to see that cool photo on a website or see that, you know, that quick video on TMZ and be like, wow, that looks like an exciting lifestyle. But it's important to remember that that moment in time is just a small snapshot of what may have been a 6-month press tour where you're dealing with routes and accommodations and threats in different cities and inappropriate pursuers and harassing and stalking and, you know, bad guys and good guys and good guys who turn bad and bad guys who might actually be good and people who used to love you but now hate you and people who hate you but now love you, and trying to differentiate all of those variables to help an individual not just do whatever it is that they need to do in the safest way possible, but also to instill the confidence that you can help them to be as successful and as safe as possible is a lot of long hours, a lot of hard work, a lot of research, a lot of planning. You know, it's like one of those things where you don't realize in the military for every door you kick down, it's like 100 hours of work because you have to plan, you need the intel, you need the maps, the terrain models, all of this stuff. And so and don't get me wrong, it is a wildly exciting career and I have arguably the best job on the planet. But it is by no means a cakewalk.
I'm joined by Spencer Corson, an expert in threat management, founder of the Corson Security Group, and author of The Safety Trap, a security expert's secrets for staying safe in a dangerous world. Would people be surprised at the amount of threats or the type of threats that those kinds of public figures get on a regular basis?
Yes, absolutely. Because, you know, it's not like in the old days where if you wanted to target someone, you had to know who their agency was or know where the studio address was.
Right.
And, you know, write them a letter. And, but, you know, by the time you were so aggravated or so upset about something, the time to write the letter, to get the paper, to, you know, think what you wanted to say, you messed that letter up. You got to write another one. Then you got to get a stamp. Then you got to put it in an envelope. It's like most people just lost the investment of time, effort, and energy by that point. So the advent of social media, like, you can harass someone via Twitter while you're, you know, picking up your dog's droppings. It's the requirement is much less. So the challenge is when managing and assessing these threats is just weeding through the sheer volume of them all to differentiate those who are expressing a threat and those who pose a threat, from those who are disruptors to those who are predators. And there are very key indicators to look for when assessing those threats, but you know, it used to be a big deal if a public figure got 500 threats in the course of their entire career. Now public figures are getting 5,000 threats a day.
Yeah.
Via social media.
When you're protecting those kinds of individuals, you're obviously handling all the details like you had mentioned before, but is part of it also training them in a sense as to what to watch out for and how to protect themselves if need be, kind of like what you're laying out in this book?
Yeah, and not just them, but their entourage, their publicists, their lawyers, their staff, their assistants, their executive assistants, their housekeepers, their gardeners. Because while someone may not see everything, everything is seen by someone. And, you know, I kind of talk about in the book about the importance of like recruiting local assets. So like when we go to restaurants or if we go to hotels, we're asking we're also recruiting the valets to look out for us because maybe they know who the local paparazzi are and they know where they like to hide out to, you know, bait people for a photograph. Or, you know, there's like this local guy is homeless and harmless, but this local guy is harmless and is definitely going to ask you for money. Or there's just so many factors that go into it. But yes, absolutely. The more you can encourage not just the celebrities, but everyone in their orbit and for everyone in our own everyday lives to actively participate in their own protection, the more we can help to ensure the certainty of safety for everyone involved.
Now, I think almost immediately when people hear about personal protection, they think firearms. But in the safety trap, you offer so many other options so that relying on having a gun at the ready isn't the only way people are able to keep themselves and their family safe. Can you run through some of the simple common sense steps people can take to better protect themselves?
Sure. So let's use the home security aspect, which you just brought up, as an example. Most people would be like, oh, well, I have a gun, so like I'm safe.
But right.
For most people, expecting them to use the number one argument against the everyday citizen using a handgun to thwart a violent offense is to watch the everyday person try to take a selfie of a celebrity using their cell phone. Because, you know, under perfect circumstances, they can take an ideal photo they can take a perfect selfie, they can take a great photo of whatever they're having for lunch. But, you know, Taylor Swift walks into the room and it's like, oh my gosh, like it's blurry, so I can't get the camera turned on. What do I do? Because, you know, under ideal circumstances where there are no stressors and we can take our time and do what we need to do, we can perform perfectly as planned. But
right.
As soon as you add excitement or some kind of life or death, you know, variable to that equation, you know, fine motor function deteriorates at a devastating decrescendo.
We all like to think that in that moment we will become Jack Bauer, but
right,
there's a lot more to it.
And that's the safe. And Ryan, you're exactly right. And that there's a whole chapter on this. It's called the safety trap of overconfidence, because we think that we will exceed our level of expectation when in reality we falter to the lowest level of training. Familiarization with a firearm is not training. If you're not putting 1,000 rounds down that weapon system a month, you are not a shooter and you cannot expect to perform as you may want. But when it comes to home security, like 85% of home invasions happen because people get complacent. They don't lock the front door, so the bad guy just walks right in. There's an analogy I like to use where, let's say, you know, we're at a supermarket and I walk up to someone in the parking lot and I say to them, hey, is your home secure? They're going to immediately say, yes, of course. Whether they lock the door or not, they're just going to promote that protective posture and say that their home is secure. So then I say, all right, there's $1 million in a backpack in your upstairs bedroom. You have 10 minutes. Money's yours if you can get it and get out without anyone being any wiser. Can you do it? They go, yep, absolutely. I can do that. So what changed in that 5 seconds? What changed was their mindset, their outlook went from that of a homeowner to that of a bad guy. Because now they're thinking, oh, well, you know, the kids, they don't always, you know, lock the garage door when they come back from soccer practice. Or, you know, we lock all the doors on the first floor, but the second floor deck doors are always open. So
right.
I can just, like, climb up there. I can get in that way. Or, you know, my wife hates it when I sink up the downstairs guest bathroom, so she always cracks that window open so I can probably get in that way. And all of those ways that you're breaking into your home are the exact same way that a bad guy is going to break into your home. So the best thing you can do is to audit yourself with real honesty, look for those areas that are most likely to be exploited, and then put in the safeguards to keep those realistic risks from ever becoming a reality.
I'm joined by Spencer Corson, expert in threat management, founder of the Corson Security Group, and author of the brand new book, The Safety Trap, A Security Expert's Secrets for Staying Safe in a Dangerous World. Let me ask you about one thing that sometimes maybe gets overlooked because our lives are so chaotic. We're thinking about so many different things. We have so much going on. But just being aware of your surroundings, knowing what's going on around you, how important is something simple like that to keeping yourself and your family safe?
The most important. Listen, most of us are never going to experience a terror concern. Most of us are never going to be in an active shooter situation. But all most people need to succeed in staying safe is a healthy sense of skepticism and a moderate dose of vigilance. We too often allow ourselves to live on these fringes of the pendulum, swinging between hyper-complacency, from complete complacency where like nothing is going to happen to hypervigilance where we're like patting down grandma at the ballpark. We need to move to the middle. We need, you know, healthy sense of skepticism, moderate dose of vigilance, not negotiating against our survival instincts. And the number one thing, not the number one, but like definitely in the top five, is employing, you know, not being too polite. Sometimes being polite is a courtesy, but keeping ourselves safe is a priority. And our unwillingness to offend another should never be greater than our willingness to defend ourselves.
And there's another component to all of this that's especially important, I think, these days, because we live our lives so publicly online. The information that we put out there, especially on social media, tell us about that component and how that plays into either minimizing or increasing the risks that you and your family may face.
Yeah, overshare. There's an entire chapter in the book about the safety trap of oversharing. And the key takeaway is that most people would be absolutely stunned to learn how much sensitive information they share online over a 6-month span. Everything from when their birthday is, to the name of their dog, to the first car, to the street they grew up on, which are all, you know, answers to, you know, password reset questions, which may, you know, be compromised for online access, but also just like how much information is available because of like data breaches. So your home address might be on a people finder type website.
Right.
And here's the thing, it's important to audit yourself every so often because, yeah, listen, if you want to post a picture, you know, today of something significant, that's great. But does that really need to live online in perpetuity for the rest of your life? Or can you go back, you know, 6 months and delete everything from 6 months ago? You can download it and save it so you'll have it for your own historical record, but it doesn't need to be online for all to see. Because here's the thing. Just because you post this information online doesn't mean you're going to get targeted. But all of that information will help those who want to target you be more successful. So why not participate in your own protection, reduce that inherent vulnerability, and do everything you can to help you and your loved ones succeed in staying safe?
I'm joined by Spencer Corson, expert in threat management, founder of the Corson Security Group, and author of The Safety Trap, A Security Expert's Secrets for Staying Safe in a Dangerous World. There's one other item on your list that I wanted to talk about, and that's first aid and CPR, because we've seen the violent incidents across this country, the mass shootings, and sometimes maybe this isn't something we think about, but having that kind of training, it could go a long way in saving the life of someone else or perhaps saving yourself, depending on the situation. What advice, what knowledge can you pass along on that tip in particular?
Absolutely. CPR, I mean, just how many people, like choking, not just being able to render first aid to someone else, but being able to render self-aid to yourself. And the great thing about being first aid qualified is that you're going to understand how important the component of blood loss is in a medical emergency.
Right.
The two things that most people don't have in their home medical kits that they absolutely should have. Number one is some kind of a blood stopper. And number two is a tourniquet. Because if you can, and listen, this isn't in case like you're in an active shooter or some kind of like terror concern. But let's say you're out back chopping wood and the axe like blade flips off, or you know you're in the kitchen and you know one of the kids like just doesn't realize how sharp the knife it is and slices their arm. Being able to being able to administer effective first aid by stopping blood loss is such an important factor because you would. The statistics are staggering as to how many household incidents turn fatal simply because the individuals didn't know how to keep themselves from bleeding out.
Spencer Corson, an expert in threat management, founder of the Corson Security Group, and author of the brand new book, The Safety Trap, A Security Expert's Secrets for Staying Safe in a Dangerous World. A really important book, a great book to get, even if it's just for a reminder on some different things that you should be paying attention to or perhaps doing to keep yourself and your family safe. Spencer, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks so much for sharing some of those tips. We really appreciate it.
Ryan, my absolute pleasure. Thank you. Thank you to your audience. This was a true pleasure. I hope I can come back soon.
Absolutely. And that's going to do it for this edition of iHeartRadio Communities. As we wrap things up, I want to offer a big thanks to all of our guests and, of course, to all of you for listening. If you want to hear previous episodes of this show, we're on your iHeartRadio app. Just search for iHeartRadio Communities. Plus, you can find me on social media at Ryan E. Gorman. We'll be back same time, same place next weekend.